The old adage, you're innocent until proven guilty, is not necessarily true, especially in today's crazy society and culture, where people, sometimes celebrities, are called out and boycotted for actions they might have done. In the eyes of society, they're guilty, period. Our guest today is not necessarily a celebrity, but John Smith was an ordinary CPA who inadvertently got caught up in the 1980s SNL crisis and found out the hard way you don't have to commit a crime to be convicted of one. John is an author and a professional speaker who shares his gripping story and the consequences of ethical and unethical behavior. His book is called Embracing the Abyss, and it chronicles his amazing true story of unknowingly becoming part of a fraud scandal and finally receiving a presidential pardon. John, it's nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Wynn. It's my pleasure.
One of the reasons that I wanted to do this program was because we have a somewhat similar backstory, and I'll get into that during the interview, but first we'll start off with your backstory. The title of your book is called Embracing the Abyss, and most people won't know what that means. So what does that title mean to you?
Well, embracing was the word that I came up with in a telephone conversation with a speech coach, and I was describing to her the circumstances and that I had seen something in the movies about the abyss, and of course the philosopher, German philosopher Nietzsche, was the one that described looking into the abyss, and the abyss looks back at you. And I took that for a man's consciousness, and that's when I decided to her, because she suggested, well, maybe you better pen this book as Avoid the Abyss. And I said, oh, no, you don't understand. You have to put your arms around this completely in order to get through it. So that's how I chose it.
Okay. Well, that helps me a little bit. So why don't you run through your backstory, not getting in great details, but hitting the high points from the time that you started working with an SNL?
Sure. Be glad to. I was with a savings and loan in Texas. The town where the savings and loan was in West Texas, Vernon, Texas. I was in Dallas. I was an executive officer for administrative matters and compliance. I was then a CPA and chief financial officer of the holding company that actually bought the SNL. In that position, due to deregulation and lax oversight, I watched the SNL grow from 80 million balance sheet to 1.4 billion in only 4 years. This would certainly qualify as the definition for a high-flying SNL. Savings and loans began having regulatory problems and ownership issues became very political. I left the company on my birthday to begin a consulting practice, thinking the world was at my doorstep. Life seemed positive until 6 months later, when a constable delivered a very large box to my front porch. This was not my impression of what being the world at my doorstep. I was being sued by the FSLIC for $540 million and charged with fraud, conspiracy, racketeering, you name it, they listed it. I dug through the box thinking it wouldn't be long before they realized I wasn't one of the bad guys, but that didn't pan out very well. Didn't matter if I didn't do anything. I didn't lie. I didn't cheat. I didn't steal. I wasn't like the others. I didn't hang out with them at the bars or fly with them on company jets to California to play with the prostitutes. I was too busy coaching Pee Wee football and Little League baseball in a small town near DFW Airport. With the help of my God-sent attorney, I faced an angry federal task force aimed at the top seven executives at the SNL. It didn't matter if you were an officer or a secretary or a bill clerk. The FBI believed everyone was guilty and involved. Criminal charges were soon filed by the Justice Department. I told my attorney in one of our early sessions that I didn't do anything wrong, that I wasn't part of whatever had been going on, that I wanted to fight it because I was on the right side. He said there was no right side, and the feds have all the might. He yelled again, "John, you just don't get it, do you? You just don't get it." Ignoring the reality of prison time has got to stop. What you don't see is that you're already on your way to prison. You can't defend yourself against the federal government. They'll run over you with their biggest truck and train and back up. Do it again. You can't stop them. If you continue to want to fight them, you take a huge risk that you'll lose all that you have. Bank accounts, investments, your home, probably your marriage. They hold all the cards, including the card of public perception. Even if you weren't involved, you won't be able to separate yourself from the others. You have effectively been thrown into a purgatory of guilt by association. My attorney concluded that my only hope of avoiding prison was to cross the Rubicon and become a member of the other camp. I would have to plead guilty and help them in their investigation, even though there was no guarantee of any leniency. On a chilly day in Dallas, I remember entering a plea of guilty to one count of fraud, making a false statement, not under oath, over a financial statement that I never saw. Sentencing was 8 months later, in October. My attorney and I had this time to prove to the Justice Department that I could be relied upon as a government witness. They needed someone with integrity. I began researching for the FBI, reviewing every file in a loan box and every box, followed by multiple interviews most days of the week. The October day arrived when Judge Maloney, known as the hanging judge, had prepared my sentence. I remember the courtroom feeling cold, looking stark. My insides were rattling big time. I was certain that everyone in the courtroom could see me shaking. The Justice Department attorneys declined our last request for leniency. They made no change in their position that I should serve prison time. The judge, now one of my adult heroes, sentenced me to 5 years probation and 500 hours of community service. I would no longer look at the ceiling when waking every morning, wondering if I was in prison. 2 years later, the judge released me from probation and publicly thanked me for my role in the investigations and prosecutions. For 14 years, I was a Justice Department witness, testifying in both criminal and civil trials. In year 15, I got a call from the senior FBI agent who had prosecuted my case. He asked me to meet him for lunch. We met, ordered iced tea. Then he became very serious. He said he wanted me to know that he'd been in touch with the Justice Department attorneys and the agents that worked the Vernon Sagan's cases. He said they were all in agreement that I should never have been prosecuted. It took me a few minutes to gather myself. After regaining control of my voice, I looked him in the eye and said, "Looks like you're buying lunch." He said he didn't know about the pardon process, but they would support me if they could. Later on, I learned that I had saved the federal government thousands of hours and millions of dollars. What most people don't know is that a pardon application causes a new investigation. My neighbors would be questioned, my employees, my friends, even my ex-wife. It's like our dear friend Yogi Berra saying, it's deja vu all over again. I hand wrote and typed the application myself. I didn't use a lawyer, nor did I consult with one. This was something I had to do myself. With fingers crossed, I signed and submitted my request for presidential pardon. From then on, after every Thanksgiving, I called the pardon attorney I had been assigned to. Her name was Hope. I told her about seeing the president pardoning another turkey on TV, and she said, now, Mr. Smith, I can't tell you anything about your pardon application. I said, yes, ma'am, I'm just checking to see if my application's in the trash or not. 5 years passed. I received a call in mid-December. It was Hope. Without haste, she informed me that President Bush has granted your pardon and wishes you a Merry Christmas. Boom, just like that. I've tried many times to sum it all up. Much easier said than done. That I survived, that I persevered, that I was a victim, that I was screwed. As time passes more and more, I believe that I may have simply been selected. As I stand before you, I know now that I'm living proof that there is a greater presence out there. Over the years, I've learned to believe in your courage and share it, to have hope for mental willpower and determination, to maintain faith and belief in yourself. I think I can. Been reaching the top and heading down the other side. I knew I could. Life has its challenges, whether we want them or not. Have faith in yourself, believe in your courage, and never give up. That's pretty much beginning to end, Wynn.
John, after you are convicted of a single count of fraud, was that a felony?
Yes, it was.
And how many years from the time that you were convicted of a single count of fraud and the time you got your presidential pardon?
That would be 14 years, 15 years.
15 years.
Yeah.
Well, unless I'm badly misinformed, for those 15 years, you lost your ability to vote. You lost your ability to have a firearm for your protection. You probably lost your ability to make a satisfactory application for anything that required a license. Does that sound about right?
Yes, it does. Very familiar.
And so, here we have a story of a person who was found guilty of a crime that he did not commit, and he was prosecuted and was forced to plead guilty to a crime he did not commit, and his rights as an American citizen were taken away. Is that about the summary of what happened?
Yes, that's it. That's the way it was. I had to live with it. It was something that I knew that I felt like I was protected. I felt like I still had God in my pocket. And that I wasn't going to be harmed by it, but I'm still getting over the stigma of it all.
Well, I can identify with you because I went through a similar type incident. Now, I'm wondering, as a result of what you just told us, did anything come out as a piece of information that would help other people if they might find themselves in a similar scenario?
Well, the press reported on all seven executives. They didn't separate one from the other, even though I wasn't part of them. It gave me something to distance myself from. I learned to stay away from those people that were in charge and could ruin my life, but they ruined it anyway. My career was stolen from me, I should say. There weren't any instructive articles or information. I was just another one of the bad guys.
It seems to me, from my experience, that when the government gets their eye on you and they think that they want to prosecute you, they really don't spend any time finding out that they're right. They have the power, as you said, and they can run over you. They've got the money, and they can make you bankrupt. So if anybody else has been through this or is going to go through this, hopefully there'll be something that can be learned from this interview that will help them. At least I hope so. What else, before we get to my story and we find out how similar or dissimilar it is from your story, what else would you like to say that is part of your scenario that maybe you haven't said yet?
It was politically driven by the other side, it was politics all the way, completely. The owners of the SNLs were trying to influence congressmen, senators, those type of people. They didn't realize that what they were doing was against the law with respect to political contributions. The FBI, when they came to their task force, came to Dallas. They were, they were hunting for blood and guts, and that's why, up until the very end, in my trial, they had political pressure on themselves to come away with a guilty sentence. But that didn't happen. So politics once again plays a role. It was something that made the regulators mad because they kept telling the people, the Speaker of the House, for instance, they were telling them, get these regulators off our backs. We can't earn our way out of this problem. And the Speaker of the House at that time, Jim Wright, he lost his job. I think that if we'd had good coverage, somebody could connect the dots at that time, but they really weren't interested in connecting the dots. They were looking more for the headlines, for the big type. Aside from that, it's a long lesson I learned, and it's a long lesson that I read about in your book. Well,
John, would one of the things that you learned is that anybody can be sent to prison for a crime they did not commit if the government wants you to go to prison bad enough, I can figure out a way of making it happen. Would that be a fair statement?
That's correct. That's a correct statement.
But most people that are listening to us today have no experience with this, so they don't even consider it a possibility. They think that the legal system is set up to give you a fair trial and get the truth out of the situation, which it is not. And like you said, quite often there's politics involved. So let me go now to telling you not the whole story, but enough of it that you'll get the idea. You can read the whole story in my book, Freedom from Addiction 3. And I was a medical doctor practicing in the late 80s in a moderately large city when the Reagan administration had their quote-unquote war on drugs, and Nancy said, just say no, and the drug czar said, we will make a spectacle out of anybody, ruin their reputation and everything if they don't do the right thing with respect to drugs, and we'll prosecute anybody that we can. And so with that kind of a background, I was running a study at my medical clinic on the use of Valium in the general population. Was it doing any good, or was it just making money for the drug companies? And doing that study required a lot of patients and a lot of medication to find out whether or not it was doing any good. So they started nosing around in the community and started going to the drugstores and asking the pharmacist, how many pills of this particular drug or that particular drug are being prescribed and by whom? And without any other thing to point their finger at me per se, they found that I was prescribing a lot of Valium, but they never asked why. And they started a investigation which lasted almost a year with two people working a full load every week to try to find something that I was doing wrong they could prosecute, because they wanted the headlines, and that was a very political thing. And so they were using the FBI and the DEA to try to accomplish that purpose. And so it went on and went on, and they weren't getting anywhere. So that was making them a little crazy, because they had invested a lot of hours, government hours, paid hours, in something that wasn't giving them what they wanted. And at that point, they decided to try another tack. And they teamed up with, I would say employed, made an agent of the FBI, my clinic person that ran the clinic, manager. And that part of the story is, this person was discovered selling some narcotics out of the pharmacy and misdirecting them to someone or ones in the community. And I found out about it. So what did I do? I went to my attorney and had papers drawn up that I expected her to sign, admitting to her guilt. And I wanted to use that to change her behavior. And that taught me another lesson. You cannot control other people, even if it's in their best interest, because some of them will do bad things. And in this particular case, she went to the FBI And she said, I work for the doctor that you're trying to get a conviction on. And I would be willing to wear wire and try to involve him in something illegal. And they said, well, we know that you have previous felony. We know that you are involved in things today that could put you back in jail. We will protect you, we'll pay you, and all you got to do is get us a conviction. So this person who was a sociopath, much to my chagrin, I didn't know that at the time, decided to sign on with the other side. And I know that you had a sociopath in Vernon SNL. We might get around to talking about that too, but if you find out that you have a person that's close to you that's a narcissistic personality type or a sociopath or whatever they want to call them, there's only one thing that you can do that's going to possibly save you or save your life. And that is get away from them as quickly as possible, making a complete cut with them. And maybe they'll go on and mess with somebody else. So this went on, secret tapings, and we wound up in federal court. And they charged me with two counts of trying to bribe a U.S. attorney. Now, how did that happen? Well, she said that I would try to bribe one of their people, and then she would refute that. She told me, being a sociopath and wanting to get her life out of the criminal system, she told me that she was smart enough that she could figure out how to do it, but she wasn't going to tell me how. And rather than what I should have done was not accept that argument, I said, well, if you can do it, do it. I don't know how you can do it. So without knowledge, I really wasn't guilty of trying to bribe anybody. But she set it up where I would give her $30,000. She said for her children's college education. And so I checked that out as much as I could and went to a firm in Chattanooga. They sounded like an investment firm. Of course, this was a government-run entity. And she said, bring the $30,000 to a hotel downtown. We'll have lunch. I'll give it to one of their officers to invest for me. I did, and as soon as that happened, 7 FBI agents arrested me with their guns and everything and whisked me away. Now, that's the basis of the story, but there's a lot more to it and a lot more interesting things that I don't have time to go into now, but is in the book. And so I went to court. My defense attorney said he was really good, the best, and I paid him over $100,000. And when it was all said and done, even though we had two mock trials to find out how a jury would react, and they both acquitted me, even though we had all that, when the verdict came back, it was guilty. And I knew that I hadn't gotten a fair trial when the federal judge started the trial by calling the defense attorney's name and said, are you ready to proceed? And he said, yes, Your Honor. He looked to the prosecutor and he said, are we ready to go? Are we ready to go? Well, to me, that sounded pretty bad. I thought the judge was supposed to be impartial. But he didn't let us put on our major witness, which was a person who had 4 doctorate degrees and would testify that the government was trying to use this taping to get something that they could criminalize. They said, well, we think, or he said, well, I think that the jury ought to be able to listen to the tapes and tell what was going on. So I didn't get to put on my defense. The other thing is, I probably could have gotten out of it, possibly in my own mind, thinking, if I'd used the theory of entrapment, because the government took a person off the street, they trained her, they paid her to come after someone who didn't have any idea about being someone who would pay the government to stop their investigation. And I thought, I am not going to do that because I have integrity, and I didn't do what they said I would do, but I would have to lie about it in court to be able to possibly get off under that defense. So that's what happened. I went to jail with the federal government. They gave me a sentence of 32 months. And the first thing that happened was they sent me to a county holding facility, a cell with 13 other people, where they kept the lights off 23 hours a day, just to turn them on for an hour to clean the latrine. And that's where I started my journey, which I describe in the book. So I prayed to God to enlighten me on why I was here. And it didn't take long for God to get back to me. He did that in a dream, a supernatural dream, where he said, you are here because you have the qualities that I need to get something done that I want done. He said, you have the intelligence, you have the stick-to-itness, you have the organizational skills, you have the enthusiasm. He might have said a few other things, but bottom line, I picked you. And if you will write this book for me, here's what I'm going to do for you. First, prison is a dangerous place, and I know that you're scared something might happen to you from one of the other inmates. Well, the first thing I'm going to promise you is that no one will touch you. You will not be harmed by anybody during this experience. He said, the second thing I'm going to do for you is I'm going to provide the money to publish the book. I know you don't have any money, so I will provide it to you. And he said, and the third thing, when the book is published, I'll have them let you go. Well, considering my possibilities, I thought, that's a great deal. I'll take it. And so at that time that I said, I will do what you want me to do, I was, as you said previously, born again. Different personality, different motives, different everything. And I've spent every day of my life since then, and that was 1990, I believe, working on this mission to help free the people who are in prison from the disease of addiction. And so what is my proof that the plan that I have was not mine but was God's? The proof is because everything God said came true. All these prophecies came true. And if you could, how likely is it that all three of those things could come true in one person's lifetime? It's way less than winning the lottery. So I never got hurt in prison. another inmate. He liked what I was doing. He believed in me, and he had his parents pay $5,000 to produce the book. And it took about somewhere around 20, 23 months to get it ready to go, because prison doesn't like anybody there to be creative. And there were a lot of obstacles to overcome, but 23 months later, I delivered to my cell block the book. I looked it over. It had what God told me to put in it. And here is the most remarkable part of this whole story. Within 40 hours, for no reason, some guard came to my cell and said, "Pack your stuff, you're going home." 23 months into a 32-month sentence, and the government doesn't have parole. So, that's why it didn't really make any difference what I did or said, or what the prosecutor did or said, or what the judge did or said, because the outcome was going to be that I was going to go to prison to be separated from the world long enough to be able to write this book that God wanted written. And that's my story. So, I think that some of the things that you had and I had were in common. We learned that the government, for whatever reason that they might have, if they want to convict somebody of a crime, whether it's to get publicity, political correctness, or whatever it is, one of the tools that they use is they use somebody lower down on the totem pole to be willing to give them information, be willing to testify to the truth, and so that they can get a bigger fish. Well, in my case, I guess I was the bigger fish, because that story was carried 10 days running above the pole in the newspaper. They got all the publicity they wanted. And so that's one thing that you should understand from listening to John's story and my story is, all it takes is the government finding somebody that will corroborate their story, and you could go to prison for years, even though you're not guilty of what they're accusing you of. And at that point in time, they'll take away civil liberty. You can't vote anymore. You can't protect yourself with a gun. You can't get a license. So it's a scary thing, John. But I think by us coming on the podcast today and kind of raising it up out of the abyss, we're going to have a lot of people that are thinking about something that they never thought about before. What do you think?
Well, rightly so. Those things can happen and will happen. On the cover of my book, it starts out saying, if this can happen to me, it can happen to you. But you and I have to position ourselves on the other end of that and look at that and say, okay, why did this happen? You came with a book. You came with a visit from God. Those are things that, you know, you were selected. You were chosen. And to an extent, I believe I was selected, because that was a mission that needed to be done. It's just that the societal rules, if you bend them or not, or break them or not, are going to still be the rules, no matter what your mission is or what you've been handed in terms of what you need to do. Your book jumped out at me when I got to the part about one of the steps of the plan, step number four, forgiveness.
How did that make you feel when you read that, Steph?
Oh, it was spot on. I mean, it was right in the middle of my heart. But that's how I ended up getting over it, was forgiving those people. And I know we went to a baseball game, and a couple of the agents, I told them that they could come with us. My wife was there, and I went up to get something to eat, came back, and my wife said, "Well, aren't you mad at these guys?" I said, "No." "Why not?" I said, "They were only doing their job. But they could have done a better job, and they could have done a better job on somebody else. But nevertheless, it was within me that requires the forgiveness for me to be a better person today."
Well, since you brought up this thread, forgiveness is something that we all need to do. I interviewed Deepak Chopra many years ago, and he said the biggest cause of illness is anger. And obviously, if you are unforgiving, you're angry. And that can totally wreck your body on the acute and on the long term. So not being forgiveness is going to do a lot of bad things to you. So you don't have to go tell somebody you forgive them. You don't have to take them back. You don't have to minimize what they did. You just have to release that anger, resentment in your own mind so that you can have a better, fuller life. And I really believe that, and that's one of the five steps in the treatment program that God gave to me. So I know that he believes that too, or he wouldn't have said it.
Well, it certainly jumped out to me. I've had a problem all my life, though, with forgiveness. This was just a larger version of my lesson, I guess I could say.
Yeah. Have you also had a lifetime experience with the inability to trust?
Yes. That's true. But I got over that too. I wouldn't have gotten over it if I hadn't had the forgiveness. The forgiveness was the key. I think you even described it as the key to spiritual development.
Yes. Well, what I think about trust is you cannot trust any human being because they have other motives, and their motives may be stronger than what they told you they would do, or whether or not they steal from you, cheat you, or whatever like that. Most people think of themselves first. And I don't really believe that you can trust anybody, but on the other hand, I believe if you don't trust people, you have a terrible mental health issue there. And it's like becoming a hermit emotionally, withdrawing from the world. And I wasn't willing to do that either. So I was willing to take the consequence of trusting until somebody did something that made them untrustworthy. But the other side of that coin is there is somebody you can trust. Only one person, and that's God. God won't lie to you. He has your best interest at heart. He'll always be there for you. And you can find out about his character by reading the Bible. And so if you put your trust in God as opposed to man, you'll come out just fine. So that's what I think about trust. And one of the things I learned is the worst thing in the world can happen to you in your mind. And 20 years later, it turns out it was the best thing that could have happened to you, and vice versa. So some time has to go by. You have to live a certain period of time before you see all the depths of what was going on back then. And so now I can appreciate the fact of everything that happened. And I have no reason to be resentful or angry because I know it was in my best interest for it to happen the way it happened. These are a couple of the points that I have developed in my consciousness, spiritual consciousness, and I really am grateful that I've been able to do that, because by applying these things and giving them to other people, they equally can develop their spiritual consciousness, and as a result of that, not need the addictive behaviors. And so for that, I'm extremely grateful. And I know that in your particular case, I'm not sure that you know the full implication of why this happened to you and what was supposed to come out of it. But if you don't, I think that you're going to find out that, and then you're going to pursue it. So I'm looking for great things to happen in your life.
Thank you. I'm looking for it too. And I know something's going to happen.
Right.
Something good.
Let me see if there was something else. In the part of your book, and this is a great book, it's an easy read. I sat down and read it in one sitting, and you ought to get a copy of it, and you'll find out more details about John, just like if you get my book, you'll find out more details about me. And one of the things in the part where you talked about spiritual development, you talked about an individual, and they called her Peace Pilgrim. I'd like,
yes,
if you could give us a small overlook of her life.
Peace Pilgrim started out early. She was quite the unusual at the time. She walked across the country, I believe, a number of times over decades, and her message was peace. And she became the Peace Pilgrim. They're still a charitable institution in back east, I believe, it's in Connecticut, that are still producing their information, her information, and it's about inner trust. It's about God. It's about how Jesus protects you. And it was a fabulous piece of work. My attorney, Steve Boucher, after the Vernon Savings thing was over for me, he became involved in Peace Pilgrim. She had pamphlets and things like that, and they took those pamphlets and he created mediation in the state of Texas. That's an unknown fact that Steve and he literally overturned the whole legal system in terms of how they barter and how they yell and how they fight. And they used Peace Pilgrim as their example. They have I still have the brochure. And he did become part of that, and he carried it on further. Mediation now is everywhere, probably every state in the country.
And I believe, you believe, and said so in your book, that God sent him special into your life to help you in the ways that he did.
Yep, I think so too. It just, I think a few more pieces need to fall into place, and then I'll understand it better.
Right. So we don't have the vision of God of being able to be seeing all the way back and all the way forward. So as long as we're here on the earth, there's going to be things we don't understand. But one thing that you can understand is you can have faith that God will do the right thing. And you should have faith in God and give him your total attention with respect to what should I do? How should I live? What should I think? And if you do that, you come out way ahead. I think I would like to make one other observation. There was somebody in your upline at the SNL who controlled all the people that was under him. And this person was a sociopath, a narcissistic personality disorder. Is that not true?
True. Very true.
And I'm not going to name his name, but I'm just going to say that that's the way it was. And I had one person in my story who also was a sociopath. And I don't know if you got that into your sociopath, but I got into my sociopath to the extent that I learned what she was like. A sociopath, for some reason or the other, believes that they are destined to or deserving of getting whatever it is that they want. And they can have no compassion for other people. They can't sympathize. They can't empathize. Whatever the sociopath wants, they're going to try to find a way of getting it. And whoever's in the way of them getting it are just people that are going to get burned. So that's why I said earlier, read up on sociopaths, read up on narcissistic personality, because I hear people all the time describing that person to me when they want help out of their situation. And the best advice, I think I said it already, there's only one thing that you can do when you determine that you have a relationship with a sociopath, with a narcissist, is cut the ties, get away from them, and go as far as possible so that they're not in your life again. And I bet you've done that with your sociopath, too.
Of course. There was no thought for anybody else but himself, none whatsoever.
Right. And he didn't care whether you went to jail for 20 years or not. He didn't care that you weren't part of the problem. If whatever he did it without caring for you. And whatever she did it without caring for me, even though she pretended to. So they'll pretend, they'll lie, but that is a mental health diagnosis that you want to stay away from.
Exactly.
Well, John, this has been a really nice talk today.
Yes.
And I think that some people are going to think about some things that they've never thought about before, because we've opened up a can of worms, so to speak, of what is out there and the possibilities of what can happen to you, even if you don't deserve it. And so thanks so much for being on the show today. Let's take the last couple minutes for you to tell people how to get your book, what contacts you have as far as email, website, or whatever you want to give them so that they can follow up with you.
Well, it's good being with you, Lynn. It's rare to have a conversation that we just had from my side, and I believe from your side, too. People can find me on Amazon, Embracing the Abyss. My website, embracingtheabyss.com. For more of that, I'm also under ethicsspeaker.com. And I'm still working on the website for Searching for Integrity. So soon I'll have that finished, I hope. That's how they can find me.
I think you told me you're working on a new book.
Yes, and it'll be somewhat of a sequel.
Okay.
And I've decided that it would be along the lines of the original book is Embracing the Abyss. The sequel will be a smaller book, but it will be Embracing Your Abyss for Addiction. How's that?
Hey, that's great. That is great. And I hope that you'll come back on the show and discuss it when you get it published.
Great. Thank you for the invitation.
So my call to action to everybody that's listening today is, if you have an addiction, ask yourself this question. Do I have a behavior that is hurting me or hurting someone I love? And if that's a yes, any behavior, can I stop it? And if the answer is no, then you're addicted to it. Because we weren't made to hurt ourselves. We weren't made to hurt our loved ones. And if we're doing it, it's something that we need to quit. And the book, Freedom from Addiction 3, will show you how to quit, no matter whether it's something really bad in your mind or something not so bad, like eating too much chocolate. It doesn't make any difference what it is. And so I would ask you to go over to my podcast. It's completely free. It's got scores and scores and scores of interviews with people like John Smith and others. It's been around for 20 years. It's the longest spiritual radio internet talk show in the country. And you can get that by putting in your browser the following address. It will take you right there, and you will see the show that came up most recently. Then you can scroll down show after show to find other ones that you are interested in listening to. And if you've got a pen and a paper, take this down, www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn.com. And or you can go over to my website, www.revwynhendersonmd.com, and you'll find that information there also. But there is hope, just like your lawyer Hope. There is hope for everyone listening today to be able to have a better life, and I wish that you will do it. So, John, thanks again, and I'll see you when your new book comes out.
Great.